Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another Peterson Car Story podcast. I am Daniel, and today I have a very special guest. He's an author, a car enthusiast, and just wrote an amazing book called Tales from the Garage. Today, we have Ronnie Kimmer. Welcome to Car Stories.
Hi, Daniel.
You just released a very amazing book. First, in a couple words, how would you describe this book?
Well, the book is really part memoir and part the memory of others. I mean, that's really what it is. And I like to think of it as the original autobiography, because it's really my history with cars from childhood up until this morning. But it's not strictly a memoir, because every other chapter is the memories of other people in their relationship to cars and car experiences.
Yeah, it's we'll get more into the book, but as you said, it's an autobiography. But just for our audience, can you let them know where it all began, where you grew up?
Oh, I grew up in the Midwest, Kansas. Kansas like tornado Kansas, and tornado like go down into the storm cellar when the tornado goes overhead, you know, that kind of Kansas. And I, even growing up, I actually had an Aunt Emmeline. So it's like I'm going into the storm cellar for tornadoes. I have an Aunt Emmeline. So when the first time I saw The Wizard of Oz, I actually thought it was a documentary.
That's pretty funny. So what is your earliest, I mean, you kind of, in a chapter, you kind of hit on it, but I'm pretty sure that wasn't your earliest memory of an automobile, but what is?
No, actually, you know, it's interesting. You know, I mean, a lot of people can say, well, you know, this was, as a kid, I played with toy cars and all that. Yeah, I did all that. But when I really thought about it, I wanted to think, well, what was the first definitive memory of a relationship with an automobile? And it's really in the chapter titled Minty Green, which was the afternoon my father pulled into the Dodge dealership in Kansas City. And we drove out in a 1959 Dodge Sierra 9-passenger wagon in Minty Green. And the reason I say that's my earliest car memory is because I had such a vivid memory of that afternoon of literally walking into that showroom with my father as a 9-year-old boy and going out in that car, and then having that car in the family until the day it was hauled off to the junkyard. So it was my first experience of car ownership, my father's car ownership, but I was there and witness to the birth and the death of that automobile. So that really kind of looms large, and I had completely forgotten about that memory, completely forgotten about it. And one day I was talking to the guy who takes care of my cars, you know, detailer and washes and so forth, and we were just talking about growing up. We were about the same age, and I said, oh yeah, I said, when I was a kid, my family bought this station wagon, and I started telling him about the station wagon, and he turned to me and he said, oh no, you have to write that story. And I said, oh, okay, I guess you're right. But what I was shocked by is that I remembered every single detail of that, every single detail.
I think it was well put in that chapter, and that was one of my favorite chapters. Sorry to interrupt you. You really paint a picture with your words in that chapter.
We're learning here as the book now is, you know, out in the world, and I'm hearing from people who are buying it, reading it, and having a good time. What it's doing, it's sparking memories in other people. And people are reading like Minty Green, and then all of a sudden they start thinking about their first car experience. And all of a sudden these memories kind of come flooding back, and things that they haven't thought of in 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So the writing apparently is evocative enough that it's triggering other people's memories. And to me, that's a success. You know, if I can trigger your car memory by telling you mine, then wow, I've done my job.
Yeah, 100%. Because one of my earliest memories also was my grandfather's station wagon.
Oh.
It was, I believe it's 74. Two or 74 Ford Country Squire.
Hope it had wood panels.
It didn't.
How can it call itself a squire if it doesn't have fake handling?
Yeah, but I remember it wasn't his primary car, but I always enjoyed going on a ride for it, and especially sitting in the seats that lift from the bottom facing, you know, the driver, the oncoming driver. That was my memories. But yeah, after reading this chapter, really kind of brought back that memory as well. So I'm guilty of being one of those
people. My memory of sitting in that, what they called the way back, you know, the way back with that rear seat facing, you know, there was a little engineering problem though with that, which was that if you rolled down the window, which was the only power window in the car, by the way, which I thought as a 9-year-old, that was the coolest thing I'd ever seen in my life, was a power window. I mean, you know, it was just that was the coolest. But if you were in the back, facing back, which was cool to wave at the other drivers and stuff, the aerodynamics of that was that the exhaust fumes just came out the back of the car and rolled into the window. I mean, and you were just breathing those fumes constantly if you were riding in the back. There was no deflector.
Yeah. What was your first car that you purchased?
Well, like most people my age and in that period, there was just a series of one beater used car after another. You know, I mean, you were just happy to have something that had four wheels and would start and go. So I had a bunch, you know, and none of them really stuck out because they were just really kind of, I didn't have a real emotional attachment to them. They were just, thank God I have a car. That was that kind of thing. It wasn't until I bought my first new car that I had an emotional attachment to the car, which is the 1978 Honda Accord. And that chapter in the book, again, goes into quite a bit of detail because I remembered, again, every aspect of that because it was a huge deal to buy a brand new car. Huge deal. And so I had to take all my beater cars, and there was about four, I think, at the time. So even, you know, even then I was collecting cars, but they weren't really worth collecting. And sold all of them sort of in a couple day period in order to get the down payment for the Honda. But that was also because I was in Pennsylvania and I was going to move to California, and I knew that none of the four cars would make it to California. And since I was going to start a new life here, I needed a reliable car. And the only thing was to buy a new car. So that's all outlined in that chapter, and it's called You're the One That I Want, the Olivia Newton-John, John Travolta song, which was the number one song in 1978. So that kind of stuck in my head when I was purchasing that car.
And do you still have that car today?
You bet I do. Which is really kind of remarkable in a lot of ways. People kind of said to me, well, why do you still have that car? And I have one friend who said, one day he's looking at me and he's looking at it, and he said, you remember we were growing up? And he said, there was always one guy in the neighborhood, and he always had, you know, like this really old car. You know what I mean? Everybody else had kind of, one guy just was an old car. And he looked at me and he said, you've become that guy. And I said, yeah, but the difference was back then, if there was a guy who had an old car, it looked like an old car because the styling was so different and everything was different. By the time, you know, the 50s, the 60s rolled around, you know, cars looked physically different. Now, a 1978 Honda Accord really blends in, you know, it really does. I mean, unless you're really looking, you're not going to pick that car out immediately.
Do you remember how much you paid for it back then?
How much did I pay? Yes, because I didn't have any money. Yes, we always remember the purchases that we make when we don't have any money in our pocket. How much did you give it? That car, the 78 Honda Accord, that was the first year of the LX model, which was their fully loaded. And really, that car changed the Honda Motor Company. I mean, the Accord just changed everything. Up until that point, it had been the Civic. And I think the Accord was launched in 76. And then 2 years later in 78, they launched the LX. And the LX had, you know, power assist steering. It had air conditioning. It had a digital clock. It had beauty rings on the wheels. It, you know, it had all these creature comforts. I think out the door, I think that car was about $6,000. I didn't have $6,000. So not only did I have to sell my fleet of beater cars to get the down payment, I had to go get a loan, which, and then I outlined this in the chapter. It was like, all right, how do you get a loan when you only have debt, which was student debt, you don't have a job, and you're now out of school? But you got to convince some lending institution that, yeah, you're a good risk. And what I learned was that, you know, appearances are everything. And in my beaters, my four beater cars, two of them happened to be old Mercedes, which was great. Because on the credit application, it says vehicles owned. So I got to write down 1952 Mercedes, or 51 Mercedes 220 sedan, a 1961 190 Mercedes sedan, you know. So on paper, I was already a guy who owned two Mercedes. So, you know, it's like, well, he must be doing okay. The combined value of those two cars at that time, one wasn't even running, the combined value was probably $500. But they didn't ask, you know, really what the value of the cars were. They just kind of said vehicles currently owned. So I looked great on paper.
Yeah, Mercedes on paper looks pretty good.
Great. I mean, you know, how old was I at the time? 20-something? Since I couldn't write down an employer, you know, that was a big negative. Anyway, I got the loan, and, you know, I made payments on that car for a long time, you know, until I owned it. And then I never got rid of it because I think at one point I decided I didn't want to be that guy who grows up and he gets older and he has some money in the bank and he starts to lust after that first new car. You know, guys like this. So then they spend a huge amount of time and a huge amount of money tracking down that first car, you know.
Oh, yeah.
They spend too much money on it. And then they spend way too much money restoring it and fixing it and putting it into some kind of condition. And I was just talking to somebody about this the other day. And I said, really, what they're doing is they're just recapturing their youth. They're just reaching back and saying, I remember what I felt like when I drove this car. I remember that I didn't worry about my taxes, and I didn't worry about my vaccinations, and I didn't worry about what girl I was dating or boy or whatever I was doing. I wasn't, those things weren't in my, you know, I just had a free life. So when people go back and they get those cars, there's this feeling that you get in the car and you have been transported back. And I know it's a bit of a cliche, but I always say that, you know, cars are really just sort of metal boxes of memories, because they have a way of triggering memories that, unlike anything else.
Yeah. And the nice thing is, you know, with memories also comes, everyone has a car story, hence the podcast.
Everyone has a car story. But I preface that by saying some are better than others.
Exactly. No, you mentioned the 51 Mercedes that you own, and it's actually a chapter in the book, just to let our audience know, and the journey that had.
Journey that had, and is still having. It is the cover of the book. It still occupies one of my garage spaces. That was an interesting story, too, because it was like, that's when you know you're really a car-crazed person, when you find something like that, and against all reason, there was no reason for me to buy that car. Again, I didn't have a job, and, you know, and I had no place to put it, and it really wasn't running, you know what I mean?
Yeah. But
anyway, because I fell in love with it. I just thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's been part of my life. And sometimes I think, oh, well, this will be the year I'm going to restore it. And, you know, no, it doesn't happen. And, you know. So I have a feeling that's going to be left to somebody else to do. Who knows, though? You know, who knows? I may wake up one day and say, okay, the desk is clear. The book is out. I think I'll restore the 51 sedan. Also, the fact that it's a four-door sedan doesn't make it an extremely valuable car. If it had been a convertible or a coupe, I would have done it a long time ago. But the four-door sedans, even though they're pretty rare, I mean, in 50, it was the first kind of luxury car that Mercedes put out after the war. Mm-hmm. They used it at the 51 Frankfurt Auto Show, and it was a six-cylinder car, and it was, you know, it was a kind of a luxury car for them. The sedans, they didn't port anything to the U.S. at that point. I think they only made like 3,500 of those sedans. That's very few cars. So, and how many are in this country is even fewer. We know Four Doors just don't get the love, you know, they just don't. Even though I think it's a cool car, value wise, not so much.
I think it's a cool car.
I deal with it. Maybe I'll sell it to you. Maybe you're the one who's going to restore it.
Yeah. But yeah, as there's a lot of wonderful chapters within this book, but what was your favorite chapter?
You know, really, it's really hard to pick one. You know, this is like picking your favorite child. And the reason is because it is part memoir, I can say, gee, well, I really like that part of my life or that part of my automotive history. That was a really fun part. So it's really hard for me to say, like, oh, really, this one. I mean, some of the stories about other people are extremely moving to me, too. There's a piece in there about Bruce Meyer and the Meyer Manx called A Tale of No Tale. And that piece, it was just a chance encounter. I was at the car show at the design center, you know, every year. And just by chance, I was sitting down having lunch, and he, Bruce, and his wife, Winnie, sat down next to me, and I didn't recognize him. And then we sort of all introduced ourselves, and suddenly I went, "Me, Bruce Meyer, the Myers Manx, that's you?" You know, and I was just kind of like dumbfounded. Anyway, we had this terrific lunch, and he and I just hit it off. You know, there was something about I was the right person at the right time for him to talk. And he just kind of told me his story, and I went home and wrote it. And it's a lot of people cite that as one of their favorite stories.
It's nice to see that the brand's coming back and staying alive and paying homage to Bruce.
Because they Bruce and Winnie sold it. And then I know that the Peterson has the Manx Cafe downstairs.
Yeah. And also one of our board members owns the company.
Oh, so. That's right. Winnie, I have to tell you, it couldn't be nicer and so forth. And when I wrote the piece, what I usually do if I'm writing a piece about someone else other than myself, I will call them up and read them the piece just to make sure that it is accurate, you know, that I haven't made any historical errors.
Mm-hmm.
Read it to her, and then there was this long pause, and she said, "Wow." She said, "I can't believe you got all of that out of him in one lunch." She said, "So much has been written about him over the years, but," she said, "this one really does capture the essence of him."
Mm-hmm.
And I was just so flattered, you know, I thought, oh my God, you know, but he and I just hit it off, you know, we made some kind of cosmic connection, and he just opened up to me. It was fun. It was really fun. I like that piece quite a bit.
Yeah, I think that's what makes this such a great book, because you were able to capture so many details in the stories in a matter of no more than maybe 3-4 pages max. Some chapters are 2 pages.
Some of the stories are 2 pages, and some, I think the longest, I think, is 6.
And for people that haven't came across a book, it's really designed to look like a owner's manual.
Well, right? I can tell you how that evolved, really, because as I was starting the idea of creating the book, the first thing I came up with is I kind of went, well, you know, cars are longer than they are tall, you know, so a regular vertical book does not lend itself to a book about cars and car stories, because they're long. So I knew immediately I had to do a book in this format that was longer than it was tall in order to show the images of vehicles. Then I kind of, that was one decision. Then the next decision to get to the size became, I wanted something that was familiar. And I realized that everybody is familiar with an owner's manual and how that feels in your hand. You know, that it fits in the glove box. And so I decided that that was the perfect shape because it felt like cars.
It's familiar.
Familiar, exactly. Yeah. But then the biggest thing, I don't know, do you want to talk about artwork? Because that was the big challenge. Well, I have a magazine background, and I write for a lot of different car magazines, including Finish Line. I think I've written 8, 9, 10 pieces for Finish Line over the years, and some of them are in the book. So I, you know, I gave it a lot of thought, and I thought, well, you know, my magazine background is that it's the graphics that pull people in the story. You know, when you're thumbing through a magazine, it's the picture that you go, "Ooh, what's that?" And then you look at the title, and that intrigues you or doesn't. And then the pull quote sometimes will pull you in. Then you read the text. So when I thought about doing my own book, I thought, well, I don't want it to just be opened up and there's all this text and an occasional square picture of a car. It just seemed really boring to me. And I've seen a lot of books like that. And I wanted it to be kind of visually exciting the way I feel that cars are visually exciting. What I did was I took the pieces and then I hired a graphic designer. And then he and I worked together to develop each one of these chapters, because each one, first of all, these are never published designs. They're all fresh. Each one is unique to the story. Each one has its own graphic language. Each one has its own unique font, other than the text font remains constant through the book. But the fonts of the titles and so forth are all different. And I decided that I wasn't really going to repeat any colors, so that each chapter has its own color palette. Each one has its own graphic thing. And the reason for that is that you can pick this up and just pick it up and read whatever you want to read. If you're attracted to yellow, oh, look, there's a story that is cut yellow as its main color. I'll read that one. Or if you see the picture of the dune buggy, you say, oh, that, or the Rolls Royce, or the Duesenberg, or the Honda, or the BMW. What if you're attracted to the car? There it is. But I wanted something that invited you into the stories. And so that's why, and that took the long to develop all the individual graphics for these stories. It took a long time. Some of them happened very quickly because I worked with a designer and he and I would talk and I would say, okay, I want something that's like this, you know? And so he would come back with a couple of ideas and I would say, no. So it was just a lot of back and forth and back and forth. Some of them happened in two drafts. Those were happy days. We'd say, we got it, lock it, we're done with that one. Others, 15, maybe 20 different designs to get to it.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. It took most of the pandemic to do the book.
Wow. Now that you mentioned it, so how long did it take to write this book in total?
How long was the pandemic? I think I can thank the pandemic. You know, can we thank the pandemic for anything? I don't know. I can thank it for the book. You know, like, gee, what did you give me? Oh, you gave me COVID. Oh, but you gave me this cool book. Well, because we weren't going anywhere. You know, we were all home and like, okay, how much can you do at home? So that's when it started. So I would say probably two and a half years from start to finish.
The first chapter in the book has a Peterson connection to it about a very special car that seen many, many miles on the road in many years. Can you tell our audience what that connection is and what the chapter is about?
It's a great story. It's a great story. I knew John Frankenheimer and his wife Evans as social friends and so forth. John had bought that car in 1963. They had ordered it in London when John was in Europe filming a movie called The Train. And they had gone over to London one day to buy some clothes and blah, blah. One thing led to another, and they found themselves in the Rolls-Royce dealership on Conduit Street in the pouring rain. One thing led to another, and suddenly he's buying Evans this beautiful car. So they had it their whole lives from 63 up until John passed away. And then Evans had it. And then as she got older, she was driving it less and less. And I drove it for her a few times, you know, just to keep it running and going and great fun. Everybody gets out of your way in that car, by the way. Everybody gives you a wide berth. I didn't kind of realize that aspect of driving a car like that because it's quite large. But everybody just stays out of your way because they feel like bumping into you, no good can happen from that. So it's amazing, the ring of protection that you have around yourself. It's almost like a heat shield or something. Anyway, she was driving it less and less, and then she kind of realized that, well, maybe it's time for it to move on, but she wanted to be the only owner of that car. And, you know, her initials are on the driver door. As she was the owner driver of that car. So we started looking, she wanted to donate it. So we started looking at the various automobile museums, you know, places where it could go. And it became very clear to me and to her, because I was helping her do this, that the only place it belonged was the Peterson. I mean, that was the only place. So we did that. We made all those arrangements and all that. But at some point during that, she turned to me and she said, would you write the story of the car? And I went, oh, I would love to write this story because it was such a unique story. So I did. So I did write the story of essentially from birth of the car to when they ordered it up until the day we put it onto the flatbed and had it taken down to the Peterson. So I was able to write that story. That story appeared in Finish Line, and it appeared in the Rolls-Royce magazine, and it's appeared in a number of magazines. But it's a unique story because, you know, one owner, all this stuff. But, you know, the amazing part of that story, and I'm sure you know this, was that John and Evans were friends with Robert Kennedy Jr. when he was running for president. Mm-hmm. And he was staying with them in Malibu when they lived in Malibu. And John was making a documentary of his run for the presidency. So they had dropped him off at the Ambassador, and that car was idling outside the kitchen door at the Ambassador Hotel with its rear door open.
Wow. Waiting
for Robert Kennedy to step out of the kitchen and into the back seat of that car. And talk about, you know, 20, 25 feet that changed history. There it was.
Wow. I'm getting chills just thinking about it.
Yeah, it's really kind of, you know, and that's only one little aspect of that car's history. I mean, it's probably a famous moment in history. So I have to tell you this wonderful story. So we did that, and we published the story everywhere. So the story was preserved. The car was preserved at the Peterson. They are great stewards of the car, but they are also great stewards of its history. And a car without a history is just a car. The fact that these both of these are preserved, and how I know that story is preserved, that was the question you were going to ask next, I'm sure. But I was in the vault one day for some other business, and there was a vault tour going on. And the vault guide had this little group, and they were walking over to the Frankenheimer car. And I thought, oh, well, this will be interesting. You know, this will be really interesting. So I kind of moseyed on over and kind of blended in with the crowd. So I looked like a latecomer to the tour. And I just stood there and I listened to him give the history, the story of the car. And it was amazing. He had it down perfect, absolutely perfectly. Every detail, not one thing wrong, not one exaggeration, not one fact left off. It was unbelievable. And they started to move on to another car. And I walked over to him and I said, I really have to tell you. I said, you did an amazing job on telling that story. I said, you got everything 100% correct. And he looked at me and he said, well, oh, thank you. But how do you know that? I wrote it. Great moment, because I felt like it came full circle for me. It felt like I had helped to preserve the car and the door. You know, that doesn't happen very often.
No, not at all. It's almost a full circle kind of thing. With all these chapters, with the 2.5 years you said that went into putting this book come alive, what did you learn from writing this book personally?
I have a new and well-honed respect for anybody who does a book. Because you know that experience when you've never done something, you kind of go, well, how hard it can be? Everybody does it. So I'm just going, yeah. You know what I mean? But when you don't know what you don't know, you know, you're just walking into a really dark room, you know, and just hoping you don't trip over a bunch of stuff. So it was a very big learning experience and tremendous amount of work. I mean, everybody thinks, well, the writing of it's the hard part and yeah, but then there's the proofing. But in this case, all of that artwork was so, so labor intensive. And then almost near the end of it, I suddenly realized that I had taken most of the photographs in the book. I would say 98% of the photographs in the book I had taken. So I wasn't worried about them. But then suddenly I went, oh, wait a minute, there's photographs in there that I don't own. They're not mine. And so I thought, oh no, I have to go get licenses for all of these photos. It's something I had never done before. So I sort of, you know, had to kind of turn sharp left and start tracking down owners of some of these images and getting licenses so that I could use them, you know, in the book. I didn't really think about that at the beginning. I did learn a lesson, though. Take your own photos.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of, in one of your chapters, Showtime, the second image is the Ally Auto Show program. And I was just flipping through it, and it says, Ally Auto Show, Wilshire Boulevard at Fairfax, which is essentially where the Peterson is. And this is back in 1931.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't made that connection.
Yeah, and I actually went to go show our chief historian, Leslie Kendall, and he was like, wow. Like, it was just like, it's very cool. It's like, you know, who knows at what corner of the intersection they're talking about.
Also, but I wonder, if was there a building there, or was there...
Exactly.
Because I know that the LA Auto Show, for many years, was in tents.
Yeah, and it was also at the Pan Pacific Park back in the day, so right. Not too far. I like little artifacts like this. Like,
well, that's an interesting connection. I hadn't really even noticed that. I kept thinking, well, the auto show has always been downtown somewhere. I didn't realize it was that far west.
Yeah, so that's something I found in the book, which I thought was pretty cool. Another kind of like Peterson connection. Aside from the book, you know, you're a lifetime CF200 member at the museum. How did you find the museum, or did it find you?
Well, I have been aware of the Peterson since it opened in 94, because I'm a car guy, you know? And sometimes, you know, suddenly you go, there's a car museum opening in Los Angeles? Well, really, where? You know? So I've been going there since, you know, 94. And you know, I love the old diorama walkthrough on the first floor. You know, that I love that display. I knew the reason why they couldn't keep it. I mean, they had to become a modern, an unbelievable museum that they are today. But I was quite nostalgic for that walkthrough. Did you ever, were you around to see that?
Yes, when I was much younger.
Because it transported you. You know, you were transported in time, and it was like the development of the automobile in Los Angeles and stuff. I just loved it. I thought it was great. But I understood why it had to go, and they had to create a new museum. So, no, I'm thrilled with the what the Peterson has become. You know, it is just a world-class museum. And some of the displays that they do on that first floor, they're mind-blowing. They're just mind-blowing. So I love being a part of it. I think it's a great asset in the city of Los Angeles.
Are you pretty active in the Checkered Flag 200 group?
I don't go on the away trips. Okay. I just can get my act together to... But I do go to the, you know, anything local that the Checkered Flag...
Do you collect any cars today? I mean, I know you have a couple.
Currently, I think there's 8 in the fleet.
Okay. And which one is your favorite?
Not a collector in the sense of, you know, I have to have, you know, this Ferrari, or I have to have this. I'm not that kind of a collector. I like cars for different reasons, you know, and there's really almost no car that I can't find some reason to like, with a few exceptions. You know, you'd have a hard time getting me interested in a Prius, or, you know, I mean, really no interest in those vehicles at all, because those are just appliances to me. You know, they're not really cars, they're appliances, and that's the way they're treated. You know, cars are, to me, are ones that are fully designed and with a purpose and with a sense of artistry, you know, where you're combining functionality and beauty. So I really am attracted to cars visually. That's always the thing that gets me first. It's like, I don't care what engine's in it. What does it look like? You know, is it cool to look at? You know, does it evoke something? So that's really, you know, and I'm a buy and hold kind of guy. I wish I could be that guy that, you know, is attracted to a car and has it for a couple of years and sells it and gets something else. I'd love to be that guy. But I get vested in my cars. You know, I spend time working on them and fixing and doing stuff. And, you know, it's like, oh, wait a minute. Do I really want to get rid of this? So the fleet kind of grows. And then you kind of, then you're faced with, how do I keep all these things going? Yeah. Car collections are great, but unless you have a big staff that's going to take care of them for you, that becomes your full-time job.
Yeah, 100%. If money wasn't an option, what car would you get? What's your all-time dream car, I guess?
Yeah, you know, that's a very tough question for me because I am attracted to so many different vehicles, you know, for different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
The one that really, I think, stands out to me, the one that still makes me, if I see one parked somewhere, I still pull over, stop, get out, and go over and look at. And that would be the 280 SL Mercedes. There's something about that car, the compactness of it, the build quality is so incredible. And there's just there's an appeal of that car to me. And I sort of keep chasing it. You know, I keep going, well, someday I'll find the right one. You know, and I've dated a few, you know, I've you know, gone to the pre-purchase inspection stage on a couple. So I've gotten that far with it. But I think cars like that sometimes, I think, that are like cats and dogs, that they sort of find you. You know what I mean? It's like, it'll match up with me eventually, you know. You sort of put it out into the universe and say, I'm looking for this car. And sometimes the universe is listening, you know?
Yeah. Time will tell. But just wrapping this up, just for our audience, if they want to learn more about you, more about the book, where they can find it, the floor is all yours.
Okay. Well, currently the book is, well, actually, the book will be in the Peterson gift shop if I get my act together to get them over there. I just talked to Bobby. So the Peterson bookstore, but the easiest one clearly is Amazon. Amazon Books, Tales from the Garage. Easiest way to get the book, and they're actually promising next day delivery now, I just saw, is talesfromthegarage.com. Talesfromthegarage.com is the website for the book. It has all the quotes, you know, the advanced quotes from people, and then just a button to press, you know, to order the book. I have to say one thing about the book. When I finished, I decided that I wanted to get, you know, advanced quotes from people that had, you know, profiles, because I didn't have a profile. And I have to tell you, I got 15 of the most amazing advanced quotes from people, and people who didn't know me, didn't know the book. I mean, they did look at the book, obviously, before they wrote a quote, but this group of people was so generous and so, you know, generous is the word I keep coming back to, because they didn't know me. They didn't know the book. And here I am knocking on the door saying, would you please stop what you're doing? I know you're busy, and read my book and then write a nice paragraph about it. That's a big ask. That's a really big ask. And if you look at the front of the book, I mean, it's kind of the who's who of the car world. I mean,
it really is.
Bruce Meyer, I mean, he was generous. Terry Kargis was extremely generous. Jay Leno, Dan Neal at the Wall Street Journal, Terry Tonis at the president of the LA Auto Show, Mark McCord at Hemmings, Angela Van Bogart at Old Car Weekly. All of these people were so generous with their time and so generous with their helping me get this book out the door. Because a lot of people said, well, how did you get all these people? And I said, well, the old joke, it's like, how do you eat an elephant? You know, it's like one bite at a time. You know, it's just like you get one quote, you know, and then you go, okay, now see if I can get another one. With all modesty, I like to think that the material was good enough that all of those people responded so positively. And that's certainly being evident in the emails that I'm now receiving of people who have bought the book and read it. And, you know, I get two responses. One is, well, I got it and I sat down, I was just going to read one chapter, and I got so riveted that I didn't get up until I finished the whole book. Well, that's like the highest compliment that you can receive. And I've gotten a number of those. And then the other one is people buy one and they go, this is great. I know six people that I have to give this to. So it's kind of become a stocking stuffer Christmas gift for people, which is great. It's great because you don't have to be a car person to like these stories, because they're not the car, you know, the car is the way in the door. They are the stories of human nature and human behavior and human emotion. And that resonates with people. So the boys come for the cars, I say, and the girls stay for the stories. I'm hearing from a lot of women, too, are enjoying the book and saying, I'm not even a car person, and I love these stories. So I know I succeeded when you start to get emails like that.
Yeah, it's an easy read. It's a fun read. You could finish this in one setting. So just for our audience, go get one, Tales from the Garage. Rodney, thank you for being on Peterson Car Stories. I appreciate you taking the time to come on here. And everyone listening, go get the book. Rodney said it's a good stocking stuffer, especially this time of giving.
But if you have any interest in cars, there's something in this book for you, believe me. I had this one woman friend, she wrote to me and she says, you know, I'm pretty obsessed about cars. She said, but you are way in a different league after reading this book. And I went, oh, was it that apparent? She said, oh, yes. She said, you've kind of kept that slightly hidden. And then she said, I had no idea that this obsession with cars goes back as deeply as it does with you. But anyway, I got to do the fun thing, which is write about something you love, you know?
Well, thank you again, Ronnie, for being on here and everyone that's listening. Stay tuned for next week for another Peterson Car Story podcast. I'm Daniel. Ronnie, thank you for your time. We'll see you next week.